Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Catechesis. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at how the early church prayed for St. Peter on the eve of his trial in Jerusalem. Never too young to be trafficked. We hear from participants at a Vatican-sponsored international conference on combating human trafficking and discover that even children as young as 7 are being used as household slaves in Britain. And from agnostic to Dominican friar. With the International Eucharistic Conference in Dublin just 1 month away, we learn more about a new free iPhone and iPad app for this event from its designer, a Dominican friar who was brought up as an agnostic before joining the church in his 20s. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict looked at St. Peter's miraculous liberation from imprisonment on the eve of his trial in Jerusalem in his continuing catechesis on Christian prayer. Emma McCarthy reports.
The story of how God freed Peter from prison tells us that the church, each one of us, goes through a night of trial, but that it is the unceasing vigilance of prayer which sustains us. This was the focus of Pope Benedict XVI's lesson this Wednesday, as he continued his series on the power of prayer, as recounted in the Acts of the Apostles.
St. Luke tells us that as the church prayed fervently to God for him, Peter was led forth from the prison by an angel of light. Peter was sleeping, a sign of his surrender to the Lord and his trust in the prayers of the Christian community. The fulfillment of this prayer is accompanied by immense joy as Peter rejoins the community and bears witness to the risen Lord's saving power.
Speaking in Italian and in a very personal comment on the narrative, the Holy Father, who is the 264th successor of the Apostle Peter, told the thousands who crammed into the square for the Wednesday audience,
"Mi sono sempre sentito sorretto dalla preghiera di voi, dalla preghiera della Chiesa, soprattutto."
I too, from the first moment of my election to the pontificate, have always felt supported by the prayers of you all, by the prayer of the Church, especially the prayers of the faithful. This particularly during difficult times, and I thank you from my heart.
Soprattutto nei momenti più difficili, ringrazio di cuore.
And Pope Benedict concluded that with constant and trusting prayer, the Lord frees us from our chains, guides us through every night of captivity that can gnaw at our hearts, gives us the peace of heart to face the difficulties of life, even rejection, opposition, persecution.
And I pray that united in constant prayer, we will all draw ever closer to the Lord and to one another.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Testing, 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 testing. Testing, 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 testing. Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature programme. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's programme, Papal Catechesis. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at how the early church prayed for St. Peter on the eve of his trial in Jerusalem. Never too young to be trafficked. We hear from participants at a Vatican-sponsored international conference on combating human trafficking and discover that even children as young as 7 are being used as household slaves in Britain. And from agnostic to Dominican friar. With the International Eucharistic Conference in Dublin just 1 month away, we learn more about a new free iPhone and iPad app for this event from its designer, a Dominican friar who was brought up as an agnostic before joining the church in his 20s. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict looked at St. Peter's miraculous liberation from imprisonment on the eve of his trial in Jerusalem in his continuing catechesis on Christian prayer. Emma McCarthy reports. Human trafficking is now one of the gravest criminal challenges confronting the international community. UN experts estimate that 2.4 million people are trafficked globally, and the annual profits generated from this trade in human beings are as high as $32 billion. Given the huge and transnational nature of the problem, Pope Benedict has placed significant attention on the moral crisis caused by trafficking and has spoken out on several occasions against the evils of this trade perpetrated by unscrupulous criminals. As part of its efforts to help the most exploited and vulnerable, the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace on Tuesday hosted a conference on human trafficking in conjunction with the Catholic bishops of England and Wales. The one-day conference brought together people representing the church, law enforcement agencies, NGOs, religious orders, and a variety of embassies from various countries throughout the world. One of the speakers at the conference was Assistant Chief Constable Olivia Pinkney of the Sussex and Surrey Police Force in southern England. So, what for her is the most distressing aspect of the human trafficking trade?
I mean, this is a horrific crime, and in the UK, human trafficking is very much viewed as serious and organised criminality. But the most distressing element is that people are viewed as commodities. You know, one can trade in firearms, one can trade in drugs, or you can trade in people. And it is the sense that someone's humanity, someone's dignity is utterly irrelevant. It is simply that someone is being traded. It's modern-day slavery.
And how easy is it to raise awareness among the general public that this is going on, in a sense, almost under their noses, maybe behind walls and doors, but is going on, and a lot of it as well, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we really don't know hard facts and figures about the numbers, but I believe very passionately and know from experience that there are trafficked victims in every area of society. This is not something that just happens in our big cities or just happens to foreign people. This happens in rural communities. It happens in rural towns. It happens to British people. And awareness raising is absolutely critical. In my view, I equate the general awareness of trafficking to where we were in the UK with domestic abuse, domestic violence, perhaps 20 years ago, in that it was, as it is now, so prevalent, and yet either people didn't quite know what to do if they did suspect it was going on, or indeed didn't look and understand the signs. And therefore, for me, one of my huge priorities is to try and get the general public, but also people who are first responders, be they health, be they education, be they whomever, to know the signs for someone potentially being trafficked and then have the confidence to know what to do about it. Because actually, the support for victims is extraordinary if one knows where to go and how to find it.
The importance of raising awareness was also emphasised by another participant at the anti-trafficking conference, Detective Inspector Kevin Hyland, who heads the anti-trafficking unit at the Metropolitan Police in London. A practising Catholic, he helped set up a partnership with the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales to fight human trafficking through boosting awareness and encouraging victims to come forward and seek help.
Prevention is always the best route, particularly in law enforcement, because if you stop someone becoming the victim of crime, that is the ultimate that we want to achieve. I think this partnership, the relationships that we have with the NGOs and the abilities of the Catholic Church and other NGOs in the countries where victims come from, that is where the prevention can actually take place. And there's very simple things that we're trying to achieve whereby there's systems set up where people are promised jobs. They can go to their local parishes, they can go to their local priests, and then contact the priests and parishes in the country where their work is intended to see if there is some job, if it's a reality. I've actually had that where I've had the International Organization on Migration contact me in India to verify whether a job was true in London. It turned out it was a bogus job. So there's very simple steps that can be taken around prevention. And I think if we're working like that globally, we can clearly prevent a lot of trafficking taking place.
Now, as you said, you've set up a partnership with the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales to pool resources in the fight against this trade. Are you beginning to see any fruits already from that partnership?
Absolutely. A very good example of that would be the conference that we held not so long ago in Southwark. From that, I was identified or placed towards the Filipino community, and we identified 80 victims who we've been able to support. So from that one meeting, we actually were able to help a lot of people and shut down the route where the exploitation was occurring. And for us, of course, we are law enforcement. We do anticipate that there will be prosecutions from that.
But do we have any idea how many million people worldwide end up as victims of human trafficking each year? Another senior British official who attended the conference was Detective Chief Inspector Nick Summer, who is the Operations Manager for Human Trafficking for London's Metropolitan Police. He says the sobering reality is that the cases uncovered by police represent only a tiny fraction of the true number of people who fall into the clutches of the unscrupulous traffickers.
Right, we're certainly only seeing the tip of the iceberg. I know there's huge underreporting in this arena, and one of our main missions now is to uncover the real picture of what's going on, allowing victims not only just to self-report, but with the help of other agencies to be supported in coming forward and revealing the true extent of trafficking in London. What we do know for sure is London is a migration hub. It always has been. And we know that there are a lot of vulnerable people moving into London. And with that, there will be trafficking within those migration flows, undoubtedly. And our challenge is to identify those people and obviously bring to justice the traffickers as well. So very briefly, in answer to your question, we are just seeing a small slice of the reality of trafficking in London.
UN figures on global trafficking found that trafficking for sex exploitation accounts for nearly 80% of the total. Forced labour makes up most of the rest. One of the most disturbing elements of this brutal trade is the use of children. And as I found out, the victims of human trafficking are often far younger than many people imagine. Inspector Hyland told me about one recent shocking case in Britain, where a girl from Romania was earmarked for trafficking at the age of 22 months and was groomed for this purpose.
Yeah, the child was trafficked from Romania. She was actually identified when she was 22 months old. She was taken by a family in Romania and kept there till she was 5 years of age, where she was groomed. She was then moved to the UK, and she was actually a house slave. She did the cooking, the cleaning, anything they wanted her to do, and occasionally was sent out to do begging. She was beaten if she didn't do as she was told, and when we rescued her, she had one set of clothing, that was it. That was her whole life belongings. But in the same address, they had a 53-year-old man who was an electrician. They brought him to the UK to do some electrical work. However, when he got here, he was sent out and made to do petty crime, to go and steal metal, to go and steal from shops. His punishment, if he didn't do as he was told, was he was actually raped and sexually abused.
Unfortunately, as Inspector Summer goes on to point out, the ruthless criminals behind human trafficking only see their victims, no matter how young, as goods to buy and sell.
Children are, again, just seen as a commodity. Doesn't really matter which part of the globe they've come from, whether it be Romania, Nigeria, the Indian continent, doesn't matter. The children were seen as a commodity. And they were used, in the cases that we're aware of, we've also had some children albeit slightly older, in the sort of mid to late teens, who've been brought over and put into the sex industry as well. So they're seen as a commodity, a way of making money, and or to be abused within the household. I mean, it is shocking, and it's quite difficult to grasp for a lot of people that someone or a group of people would do that. But to understand the problem, you have to go back to the source country. You have to understand the culture that sits there, that it is, within the country, an acceptable behaviour to perhaps move a child around, to perhaps sell a child. Almost a duty in certain countries of the rich to take some of the children off the street and to employ them as domestic servants within their families. And it's when you understand that you see, or what we see in London, is just a snippet of normal behaviour within their own cultures that within our law is illegal. So yeah, it is important to understand the narrative and the history and the community as well.
Certainly, the main lure of this trade for the traffickers is the huge profits that can be made with very little outlay. So, how much money are we talking about exactly? Inspector Hyland again.
If I give you an example, a woman working in prostitution in London will be worth somewhere in the region of £50,000 to £100,000 a year to the trafficker. So you only have to have 10 women working for you, or forced to work for you, and you're a millionaire. And clearly there's very little outlay. So that shows you the real revenue that's there. And those that send out gangs of children doing begging or doing shoplifting, likewise, they can earn £2,000 to £3,000 a week from those children.
Assistant Chief Constable Pinkney agrees that human trafficking is an incredibly lucrative business for its perpetrators, and one that transcends all national boundaries.
Money talks, and this is about making an awful lot of money out of somebody. Because if you think about it, if you trade in drugs, that drug is only used once. If you trade in a woman for sex, that person can be made to have sex 20 times a day, every day, for years. So, you know, the numbers add up, and therefore people will follow the money. So the nationalities will work, criminals will work across international boundaries and will work together to get what they consider their job done.
So what benefits does she hope this Vatican-sponsored conference will bring to the fight against human trafficking?
I hope that it will lead to extraordinary changes. The Catholic Church is very unique and very powerful in two ways. One is it absolutely has the local to the national to the global network. It's there, and that's very well established. So in that sense, there is already, through the Catholic Church, that element of network which can link the very local, from the individual trafficked victim, all the way to being able to influence and lobby nationally and internationally. But the other side, for me, is that often where there are societies who openly and actively traffic their women or their children, and there are those countries in the world, often the church will be trusted where perhaps the state is not, whether that's the police state or the government state. So the element of trust that the Catholic Church has and enjoys and deserves is a great, powerful tool in educating and changing behaviour in those countries as well. So there's a twofold answer to that question.
Her upbeat views are echoed by Inspector Hyland.
I think we are winning the war on this crime because we are doing it with victims in mind. Everything is focused around the victims. And now we are seeing the proof of what we're doing with the convictions and more victims coming forward.
And very briefly, to sum up, what message do you want this conference in Rome to convey, both to the church and to the wider community?
I think to the church, I think it's a great step forward that law enforcement, NGOs and the church are working in partnership. And I think that needs to be developed for the benefit of those who are being trafficked. To the wider community, I would say be aware, be informed, and then act on what you can. I mean, the church is a global enterprise, and with their support, right down to parish level, we can really make a difference.
That was Detective Inspector Kevin Hyland from the Metropolitan Police in London. And earlier you heard the voice of Assistant Chief Constable Olivia Pinkney and Detective Chief Inspector Nick Summer. Do Ireland, iPhone apps, a former Dutch agnostic, and the Dominican Order have in common? Well, they're all part of final preparations for the biggest church event to take place on the island nation since Pope John Paul's visit there in 1979. It's now exactly 1 month until the International Eucharistic Congress gets underway in Dublin. And to help mark the final countdown, the organisers have launched a free iPhone and iPad app. Using 21st century technology, the Congress app gives pilgrims from all over the world the opportunity to experience the Congress. The app was designed exclusively for the Congress pilgrims by Dutch Dominican friar Luke Janssen, who spoke to my colleague Emma McCarthy about the app and about his own faith journey from agnostic to religious friar.
Well, the app is, I suppose, just a tool for pilgrims, but I suppose also for people who might not be able to make it to Dublin this summer, to get information about the Eucharistic Congress and to be able to look up the program and, if they have questions, the frequency asked questions section and general background about the Congress. So they have an easy and convenient way to kind of look it up, because a lot of people nowadays use mobile phones and iPads and those kind of more modern means of communication to actually get in touch, I suppose, with all kinds of things. And so we felt it would be good to try and go with that and create something that will be useful for the people interested in the Congress.
So you can be a pilgrim without actually physically being in Dublin as well?
Everybody has interest in the Congress could follow it to the news feeds or to the website, and also to the app, suppose. That's another means, as it does feature all the news that comes from the Congress, and it also will feature, or it features already, some of the videos made in preparation for the Congress, and also there will be videos there that are going to be made during the Congress.
Will it also feature perhaps streaming of some of the main events, maybe through the radio channels?
There will be some live streaming. Definitely the big events like the first mass and the first mass and the final mass.
The idea behind the app really shows that it's an interactive congress. What was your role in becoming involved in this? Are you a techno freak, as they say? Are you someone who's always been interested in the new forms of communication?
Yeah, I guess to a certain extent. I feel that being a part of the Dominican Order, still a student at the moment, we're trying to kind of look at new ways of communicating, as a lot of the traditional ways of bringing the gospel to people are, well, I suppose it becomes harder, especially here in Ireland, where maybe there's less people going to Mass or less people being involved in prayer meetings. There's still a lot of people who are interested in their faith, and it seems to me that it is important to kind of grow with the rest of society in using modern means of communication. And we put quite an emphasis on trying to use video for that, video recordings. But also, in order to bring the content to people, you need some kind of a vehicle, I suppose. And developing apps for the iPhone is just one of the, as I can say, experiments to see if that is a way that we can actually connect with people or help them in discovering their faith. If that is a way that we can actually connect with people or help them in discovering their faith.
You made a very valid point there. It's not a given today that everybody knows about the faith, the church, or even God. Often in many countries, not only in Ireland, but in many countries in the Western world, the churches are unfortunately emptying, shall we say, and particularly among the young people. If I'm not mistaken, I was reading a little bit about your story. You would be one of these people who, shall we say, came late in life, even though you're still quite young, but found the faith, found God, quite late in life, considering. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yes. Yeah, that's right. I was only baptized 9 years ago. And initially, when I was brought up, there wasn't much mention of God at all in my life. So I didn't really know about God, and I think that is the situation, and definitely becoming more and more the situation in a lot of the Western world, where people are growing up. The family might not be practicing Catholics or practicing Christians. They might not go to church, and at school you don't really learn anything about God either. The school where I went, I never learned anything about God, and the only kind of, I suppose, connection I got with reality was to physics, where we were taught that, and if everything was explained by, for example, the Big Bang Theory, So it was only when I was in my early 20s, when I happened, more or less by accident, to come to Ireland to finish my studies, that I came in contact with somebody who challenged me, I suppose, on my unbelief in God. And initially, when we started talking, I thought, like, this is going to be an easy conversation, because I'm just going to say that the Big Bang Theory solved everything and that evolution shows how life started. But then when we started to probe a bit deeper into the issues, and I did a bit of reading, and we did a good bit of discussing, I discovered that it wasn't as simple as that. And there was a moment that I realized that the existence of a God is a much more probable explanation of the existence of everything around us than to believe in nothing. And my friend at that stage, he advised me to say a few prayers, maybe 5 minutes a day, and to start reading the New Testament, beginning with the Gospels. And he said it might take a few weeks, it wouldn't be an instant revelation mostly, but I must say that I kind of experienced that God was real quite soon after doing that, and everything just kind of started to make sense once I discovered that this God is actually a personal God who you can actually know. And that kind of completely turned my life upside down, I suppose.
Why Ireland?
Well, I suppose at that stage, when I was baptized in Ireland, and I received my first Holy Communion and my confirmation in Ireland. But at that stage, I was finishing up my master's. I'm an engineer, and I also had work here. And then I also got a girlfriend after that. So I pretty much was settled in Ireland at that stage, so just decided to stay here, at least for the time being.
So it really comes back to the whole idea that we have to be the witnesses, really, don't we? What are your hopes for this Congress, that we can form a generation of Irish Catholics, and not only, but of other Catholics from around the world, who will have the courage to be witnesses to their faith for others in society today? Which is not very easy, is it?
No, it isn't. But I think if we meet Christ, if we encounter Christ, as Pope Benedict so often tells us, it's a life-changing event. And even if we might not have the courage, like my friend did, who actually came to me every day to talk with me and argue with me about God, if we are people who are close to God, people will see it in us, because it changes us, and it changes us for the good. They recognize there is something in our lives that they want as well.
It's not a cliche to say that you personally found your faith in Ireland, which many people might find hard to believe today, given a lot of the negative news that is being reported from Ireland regarding the church. But the church in Ireland is a lot more than just the negative news headlines. So how would you encourage people to come to Ireland and be part of the International Eucharistic Congress experience?
Well, I would say it's going to be a great experience to meet other people from all over the world. Last year, I suppose it was the first time I was really involved in a big event, was World Youth Day in Madrid. And I know there's a lot of negativity around, but it doesn't mean that the message of the gospel is less true. We have to realize that, first of all, we have to find Christ in our lives. And the Eucharistic Congress is going to be a great opportunity to meet others, to rediscover God Himself, Christ in the Eucharist, to learn about our faith. And that will be a great experience for our lives. And it's something that we're going to carry with us when we leave Dublin again, when we go back home. It's an experience you don't forget.
That was Dominican Friar Luke Jansen speaking to my colleague, Emma McCarthy. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.